Welcome back to the Plowcast. I'm Susanna Black Roberts, Senior Editor at Plow. I'm speaking today with Matthew Scarrants and Sebastian Milbank. Matthew is a freelance writer at the European Conservative and elsewhere, and Sebastian is Executive Editor of The Critic. We are here today to talk about J.R.R. Tolkien and his mythopoetic masterpiece, The Lord of the Rings, and all associated texts, which are many. And specifically, Tolkien's vision and the question of technology. So I'm going to start us off by noting that Tolkien said that though his books seemed to be largely about power and the corruption of power, there were other issues more strongly in his mind. The quote was, "Anyway, all this stuff is mainly concerned with fall, mortality, and the machine, and with power only as it relates to those three large themes." So I guess one way in is, what did he mean by the machine? And I'm going to just let you guys go at this.
So I guess I can go first, because I actually pulled this quote for this discussion. And really, he kind of goes into depth on that in letter 96 and letter 131, and actually they just published last year a revised edition of his letters, which has quite a lot of detail that wasn't in there previously, but not much that touches on this particular topic. But you can see in his writings on the machine, he actually equates the machine to magic. He says the machine is our more obvious modern form, though more closely related to magic than is usually recognized. It's this idea of anything that really can help man, these devices that can help man dominate the real world or change the real world in this pursuit of immortality, which is the running theme throughout much of the Silmarillion and throughout parts of The Lord of the Rings. I would say it's much less prominent in The Lord of the Rings than it is in these other works.
So Lewis actually talks a good bit about that similarity between technology and the machine as well. This is, I forget where this is from, but I remember the quote when we were sort of brainstorming about this. Lewis wrote, "The serious magical endeavor and the serious scientific endeavor are twins. One was sickly and died, the other strong and throve." He said, "Science is no doubt contrasted in our minds with the work of magicians, but contrasted only in the light of the event, only because we know that science succeeded and magic failed. The event was then," so he's talking about like 17th century, basically, "still uncertain. Stripping off our knowledge of it, we see at once that," he mentioned Sir Francis Bacon, "and the magicians have the closest possible affinity, nor would Bacon himself deny the affinity. He thought the aim of the magicians was noble." So this idea of manipulating reality, not through bringing forward or bringing out the inherent powers or talents of a created being, but by imposing techne, imposing sort of external ends, and imposing your will on those beings. That's kind of the commonality. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say there's definitely an affinity there between Tolkien and Lewis, and that actually is another point that we don't have to touch on right away, but I did want to eventually talk about their friendly competition to write a series of novels, which ended up in Lewis publishing the Space Trilogy, or something called the Ransom Trilogy, and Tolkien failing to publish several versions of the same story, the Lost Road, or sometimes the Notion Club papers, which he actually investigates and interrogates what that means. And he's far more positive towards the science than, and towards the scientific aspect than you would first expect, because I think he does recognize in magic, in these this duality of magic, that it does have this beneficial and this aesthetic quality that you see manifested in the elves, and particularly in the Noldor, the high elves in The Lord of the Rings, that is beneficial to mankind, but also this corrupting element, this idea of trying to go too far, of trying to escape the limitations of nature and of mortality.
Yeah, that makes sense. Sebastian, can you, where do we see?
So I'm interested in this idea of the equation of magic and technology, because of course magic is not a monolith either for Tolkien or historically. So obviously both Lewis and Tolkien, you know, their sort of lodestar is sort of a kind of pre-modern Catholic medieval universe. That's a shared reference point. And of course magic, there are different kinds of magic, and magic is seen in very different terms based on what sort of it. So I mean, the most obvious distinction is between sort of the kind of magic that Matthew sort of talks about, which is about manipulation, language, perhaps invoking beings, spirits, angels. But then there's also a very different magic that's more kind of inherent to the nature of ordinary processes, which is, alchemy somewhere in the middle of this. But I'd say that the type of magic I'm talking about is what's often called sympathetic magic. So just the idea that essentially, you know, for example, if I have say a stone from a mountain, it's somehow still attached to the mountain. So, or that there might be kind of sympathies between different substances, between different plants. So there's an awful lot of idea of sort of the medicine, of astronomy. So the idea, for example, that if you're born under a particular star symbol, that affects your life. This is all to do with so-called sympathetic magic. And this is not necessarily a breach of the natural order, but rather simply an understanding of its sort of hidden, but no less natural processes. So to give a kind of a good example of this textually in Lord of the Rings, I think we might compare, for example, the kind of warping of nature that you see with the manipulations of the ring or the creation of the Uruk-hai. And then you can compare that with, for example, the Malorn seed that's given to Sam Gamgee. So at the end, he uses this to revive the Shire, and it produces this kind of superabundance of growth, and the soil and the seed produce this. And essentially, it's the magic of the elves. But the magic of the elves is not, as you say, to kind of assert your will on something, but simply to bring it to its highest possible geological end. So that it's much more to do with kind of sustaining life and maximising its potential rather than imposing your own purpose on it and warping it. And another, I think, very good example of this is the rope that is given by the elves to Sam and Frodo on the expedition, the one that unties itself. So again, the rope is not doing something a rope isn't supposed to do. It's just a rope that's being more ropey than anything, if you put it that way, than any other rope that can be imagined.
Yeah, I mean, the other sort of distinction that I've heard talked about, and that Lewis, I think I heard this from Lewis first, is the distinction between magia and goetia, and that would, so magia is kind of, it's high magic, it's also called theurgy, and that idea that, like, it's basically doing, it's using the inbuilt, in a technical sense, potential of things, just encouraging them to be more themselves. And Lewis actually kind of talks about Christ turning water into wine in this way. He says, basically, this is what happens very slowly, normally, you know, that water gets sucked up by grape vines. And then, you know, with the sun turns into grapes. I, as I'm told, I'm not a country woman. And then you take the grapes off and then you step on them, I guess. And then other things happen, and then finally you have wine. And so Lewis just says that Jesus, basically, when he was turning water into wine, he was just doing what God normally does, but doing it faster.
Yeah, and I think just that kind of idea that we sort of introduced, the sort of almost Arthur C. Clarke idea, which is, he says, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic if you're not advanced enough. And I think that kind of idea is sort of Bacon comes along, natural science and engineering comes along, and it produces all the things that magic promised to do but never did. But I think that's a misunderstanding, because an awful lot of things that worked were understood in magical or quasi-magical ways, but that doesn't mean that people thought they were irrational or didn't have a cause. So I think a good example of this is something like brewing. So fermentation, the production of, you know, of whether it's cheese or beer, there are all sorts of strange rituals attached to it. And there was an understanding that this was a kind of magical process, that you were changing one thing into another, you know, lead into gold. But You know, and so this idea of sort of the hidden potentiality of things being discovered by human reason has always been understood in a sort of magical way. But it, and I think the sort of the distinction that we kind of now impose between magic, as if magic is this thing without cause, without reason, that this sort of out of nowhere breach of the natural order, I think that belongs much more to a kind of later Gothic imaginary.
Now, it's interesting you bring up the terms magia and guetia, because I'm going to be quoting a lot from Tolkien's letters. It's what I've been reading recently. He actually touches on this distinction in letter 155, and he says that when Galadriel speaks of the deceits of the enemy, well enough, but magia could be, was held per se, good per se, and goetia bad. Neither is in this tale good or bad per se, but only by motive, purpose, or use. Both sides use both, but with different motives. So I think that trying to draw a strong distinction between these two kinds of operations, or indeed between good and bad technology, is to kind of miss the point that he's making in this letter. He makes this point. It comes back to what is the use, what is the effect, and how much are you using it? Because later on he talks about the evil of the multiplication table. The idea that anything in insufficient quantities, even what we would consider like the good magic, can have this sort of corruption.
The poison and the dose. I mean, this is sort of the idea of, you know, root cuttings as being, you know, the small dose can cure and the large dose can kill. There is a kind of distinction, though. I feel like we'll get to more technology stuff soon, but there's so many rabbit trails here that I feel are incredibly valuable. One is that, so in addition to like brewing and baking being sort of alchemical processes, there's also this old understanding of smithing being something magical and in a kind of sketchier way, like a kind of scarier way. And I wonder whether the distinction is like thing, because smithing seems more technological and brewing and baking seem more sort of homemaking. Is there, and clearly it seems to me that Tolkien was drawing on the idea of smiths as magical in, you know, in thinking about this, the forging of the ring as, you know, Wagner did. I mean, this is which is where he got it from.
I mean, I think there's a sense which it feels like a more pure purely technological thing. So when it comes to, if you're doing brewing or baking, you're dealing with a living thing. So you can push it so far, but no further. And you're basically bringing something out that's already there. But I think there's much more of this sense of imposing your will on something, making it plastic, melting it down, and then forming it into machinery. And even something as simple as a sword is a machine, you know, a machine that kills. And I think that sort of ability, that kind of, and at the same time, smiths are also people who are very much associated with language. So, you know, and of course, in the Norse tradition with, you know, smiths were often also people who were involved in rune magic, and they were believed to impart powers to weapons and armor. And I think that idea, you know, the local smith is often one of the few people who is literate or semi-literate. There's something similar with masons as well. They're people who are seen as having command of hidden powers, but specifically hidden powers over things that are non-living. And I think that's where the distinction comes in.
Your original, sort of the original piece that we had discussed, Sebastian, was actually specifically about repair. And there is something, obviously in Tolkien, again, it's not a simple question of, you know, smith-like magic being bad and bread-baking-like magic being good, because, first of all, it is good that the swords are made. But your point was that there's something very sort of poignant and beautiful about reforging and mending in Tolkien, and obviously that is a smithy thing to do.
Yeah, I might just read out the wonderful, because there's you know, as people who love the books will know, it's full of poetry that I always was my favorite thing. It's full of songs and poems, and there's one in particular. I'll just read a few lines. All that is gold does not glitter, Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall the blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king. And of course, that's, of course, a sort of, it's both a poem and a riddle, and is at the same time a prophecy about the return of the last line of Numenor for Aragorn. And it refers to the sword Narsil that will be reforged, and the return of the kingdom of Gondor. So that the idea of kind of political repair, literal repair, and cosmic repair are all kind of at one, I'm talking.
I feel like we should probably turn at this point to the ring itself, which is often thought to be like the most obvious sort of technological object or object of the power of the will, which inherently corrupts by its very nature. And there, obviously, that's true. But also Galadriel has a ring, and a ring built Rivendell. And so what is going on there?
Yeah, there's definitely a sense in which this is a, if we can put it in these terms, a good technology that's been corrupted. Tolkien even talks about how, let me find the actual quote here. So in a letter to Lewis, he talks about there's a specific kind of horror at seeing good machines ruined by misuse. And what we have, though, in this, the misuse isn't necessarily all on Sauron's end, because the goal of the elves is to preserve a kind of world, a particular state of the world in which they are the most powerful, when the fate of the world is to trend in a direction away from that power towards the coming domination and dominion of men. So this theme of use and misuse, of what is good about this technology, what is evil, it's baked into the very beginning, very core of that story, right? It's Sauron who gives them the crafts that they need to make this ring.
Right. So even Rivendell is not innocent in that sense. And there's something really, the mood, at least of the Lord of the Rings, and I have not read the Silmarillion, but the overwhelming mood of Lord of the Rings is a kind of like, it's not just that like grasping after power is bad. It's that nostalgia is kind of bad. So, okay, obviously there is an intense sense of nostalgia throughout the Lord of the Rings, which is, you know, very appealing and beautiful. But this sense of, as Matthew was describing, like the world is going in a direction and has a sort of natural process to itself. There are ages that succeed one another. And holding on to, even if you're basically good, holding on to an age that is passing and not allowing yourself to, you know, go into the West is itself a wrong. Even if the age that is passing was a good age. Is that, okay, now tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, no, I mean, I think that is, you know, that it's an available interpretation, and it's tempting because it's in so much of our own, it's in so much of our kind of cultural DNA, this message, don't hang on to the past, let things pass when they have to. Even amongst conservatives, it's like, you know, you're, but the curious thing is that that's, if you look carefully, you know, and I'm not just at the Silmarillion things, but, you know, even just at the Lord of the Rings, it's not quite the message at all. So the curious thing is that the elves, at least the ones who are good, accept that their age is passing, but they also see it as their duty to basically steward and sustain things as long as possible. So the point about the elves is really that they sustain things that they know are going to die, but they do it anyway. And that's, I think, a sort of a subtly different point to just the one that you have to let things pass and go on. Because the thing that's interesting is that the elves are, so that, I mean, again, there's an awful lot of things that Tolkien wrote about, as it were, his metaphysics in the background that you can see inform the book. And one of those is that the elves don't outlive the world. So basically, there is a kind of... So there is the idea of the immortal soul. People go to the halls of their fathers, as they say, in Lord of the Rings. So that's there is an idea of an afterlife. But the interesting thing is that... And this is implicit in the books, but it's made explicit in his writing elsewhere. Tolkien clearly conceives of the elves as being at one with the world. So the nature of the elves is, though they are immortal, they're actually, in a kind of cosmic sense, strangely like the ancient pagans or something. They don't expect to outlive the world in which they live. They think so that the elves, at some point, the world itself will end, and it's believed that human beings really are immortal in a grander sense. They will go on, and the human beings perhaps even pass beyond Arda. And this idea is quite interesting because it kind of invests the elves of a kind of fatalism. They're a bit like fairies or something. They're not, and we have this whole idea of elves as being, that is being built up subsequently, but we forget how much Tolkien's merging it with the ideas around fairies and sort of third things beyond humans or angels. And the elves really belong to nature and to the world and to growing things in a very strong way. And there's a sense in which human beings are in a more complicated, you know, there's this idea that you get, as in Augustine, that we're sojourners, we're pilgrims on the earth, we're not really at home here. And there's a strange way in which the elves are almost fatalistically at home in a world that they're fated to see die around them. And human beings are fated to perpetually sort of fail and fall to sin and corruption, and yet they'll continually renew themselves. So there's a sort of, there's sort of a line where Legolas and Gimli talk about human beings, and they say, you know, the seed of men is always failing its potential, but it's also always renewing itself.
Yeah, and there's a lot of language of progress around the Mordor and around Saruman and the coming of the new order, new age. The Lord of the Rings is not an allegory for World War II, but there are resonant themes with the kind of progress of World War II and the War of the Machines that we can also talk about.
What we've been doing is like complicating the story before we've told the story to a certain degree. So like, no, it's good because I feel like a lot of people who will be, at least the kind of nerds who will be tuning into this particular podcast, will know the kind of standard critique or standard understanding of Lord of the Rings as a critique of industrialization, which I think it also is. Like we have been complicating it, but I think it also is that. So let's talk about that. What is that?
Well, I'm gonna go back to my theme of it's about the multiplication. It's about the untrammeled expansion of industrialization rather than necessarily the progress of that technology. And there's a fascinating interview that the BBC did with Tolkien all the way back in 1968. There's a documentary that they made out of it called Tolkien in Oxford. It's great. I would highly recommend anybody watch it. Shows you him and his kind of natural habitat. But there's a lot of stuff that was cut because the interview was too long and they had only a short time slot on the BBC. So he's asked by this interviewer what he thinks of industry, and replies, "I have no objection to it as such." And what he thought of factories, they might be better than they are. It depends on what you mean by a factory. A factory might be very big or very small. He gets asked, what do you think of cars? He loves them. He loves riding in them, driving them. But there's too many of them. There's this evil of the multiplication table. And this multiplication of a thing, it becomes the process whereby everything becomes a resource. Everything becomes something that can be utilized, harvested, formed to meet the ever-expanding needs of artificial consumption.
He did own a car, as I understand, but then he sold it at the beginning of World War II. And he also did not like eating refrigerated food, that's extreme. I mean, I guess if you have an icebox, it's fine.
Just a little housekeeping. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. We'll be back with the rest of my conversation with Sebastian and Matthew after the break.
I feel like we need to talk about Palantirs for various reasons, just because I feel like if there is a technology, like the technology that was like rattling and, you know, reaving Tolkien's world was something like the technology of Mordor. It was, you know, I'm podcasting right now from Stoke-on-Trent, which during the Tolkien's life was absolutely hideously, you know, industrialized. You couldn't see across the street for the smoke. It's now sort of been incredibly beautifully reclaimed, and there are all these gorgeous parks that have been kind of made on top of old coal, you know, slag heaps. But so what he was seeing was a kind of Mordorian vision of industrial society. And I feel like what we're seeing is maybe a Saruman vision more, like it's something more Palantir-ish. And I think that that's interesting. And I would like to know what you guys think.
Well, the Palantir are built by formed by the elves, supposedly by Feanor, the greatest of the elven smiths. And they're given originally as gifts to the to the Numenoreans, to the best men, to make the best use of them. And over time, they too fall prey to this desire of circumventing the limitations of nature. They use them to see further and further, to see what can be known that's beyond the scope of natural human sight, even in the sense of human communication. And there's nothing inherently wrong with seeking out this knowledge, but it becomes a means by which the enemy can trap them. But Sauron acquires a Palantir. He can use that desire for information, that desire for this complete comprehensive knowledge, to trap them by presenting them with this image of his own unconquerable might. This very much this propaganda, the Nazi use of cinema, you know, Triumph of the Will. It's again this kind of theme of what can this thing do? What can this technology do? What are the limitations that it's trying to transcend? And should we actually be trying to transcend them? You know, the internet, you can find so much knowledge, but so much of it is crafted by these agendas.
Can you describe, okay, what a Palantir is and how it was intended to be used? Because I'm not actually totally clear how it was meant to be used.
So it's a globe, basically a crystal ball, but it's this fashioned globe that allows you to speak mentally and to mentally kind of see images with projected in it with the possessor, any possessor of these other Palantir crystal balls, or to see things that there's certain limitations to it, or it's not entirely clear, but to see things far away, basically. The name Palantir comes from Tolkien's Elvish languages, meaning far seer. And the original meaning of it, the original use of it, was for communication among the Numenoreans, these guys going out on ships, exploring the vast, wide world of Middle-earth. And we can talk about the Numenoreans and kind of also their tragedy of going from this kind of exploration of Middle-earth to the colonization and exploitation of Middle-earth as well.
Why don't we talk about that? Just before we get into that, it just reminds me so much that the whole paradigm here reminds me of the phrase about the dwarves digging too greedily and too deep. Like, they're dwarves. They should be digging. That's what they do. You know, you're a dwarf. You dig. But they dug too greedily and too deep. And I just wonder if that's kind of like a paradigm for how to think about how Tolkien thought about these things.
One of the reasons I raised this question about the difference between men and elves is it can feel like a very kind of Tolkien nerd, inside baseball sort of concern. But I think it actually has a lot of significance for our question because, you know, obviously Tolkien was wary of allegory, but I think there's a clear sense in which, you know, the kind of the reason Tolkien doesn't just make it a historical fantasy, you know, why have elves and dwarves at all? Are they there just to be colourful? I think the kind of part of the purpose it serves is that elves almost represent an older, more different, sort of more kind of mythic sort of way of thinking about the world. So it's interesting that elves, they're almost, you know, they're their own thing, of course, in Tolkien, with their own significance. But if there's an analogy, it's almost between something like a Homeric or kind of ancient Celtic or Norse way of being. So that if you think about the way human beings are corrupted versus the world's elves are being corrupted, it's really interesting because I think it speaks to totally different ways of thinking about technology. So, you know, I think the example of, you know, Fëanor, you know, invents the stuff like the Palantir. But if you think about how Fëanor and the sons of Fëanor corrupted, it's in a totally different way. It's through honour culture, basically. They swear this oath saying that only they can possess the Silmarils. It's not that they have ambitions to dominate the whole world with them. It's that they have a much more kind of archaic vision of kind of pride and honour and a sense of their own status. It's much more kind of linguistic and about your kind of relative status in the eyes of your fellows. Whereas it's not that human beings don't have those ideas, but you can see there are all these other things being layered on top of them, so that the Numenoreans are trying to establish an empire. They want kind of control of matter. They want, they have religion, they have abstraction, organized religion, I should say. You know, there's far more of this idea of a sort of what we think of as kind of modern science, technology, systems of domination.
Actually, I have to mention that at one point, Tolkien was considering giving the Numenoreans airships, and this was later cut. But I think it plays back into that, like what you're talking about, Sebastian, because there's this great point in his poem, Myth of Poeia, where he talks about great powers they slowly brought out of themselves, he's referring to men, and looking backwards, they beheld the elves that wrought on cunning forges in the mind. So there is this sense in which the elves represent this older conception of humanity, or humanity conceiving of itself in this heroic age compared to the current age, where the Iron Age, where things are dominated by matter to a certain extent.
I mean, it's so hard not to, just maybe just because I've been kind of in rereading or thinking about Nietzsche lately, it's very hard not to see this in terms of like a kind of like either Nietzschean or Barfieldian way of understanding, like, okay, we are people who are separate from the world, and that's given us great power. But there's a kind of, what we miss is the kind of original participation that Barfield describes. We miss that kind of sense of immediacy, being bound up with the natural world, even though we are in a certain sense more powerful. Like in a certain sense, men are more powerful than elves.
There's also a sense in which there's definitely a theme of ecological conservation in Tolkien, but there is a sense in which one can take this too far. One can invert the kind of natural order, place the material world, the world of the elves and ents and dwarves, above the world of men. Whereas in another unfinished work, Tolkien's unfinished sequel to The Lord of the Rings, The New Shadow, there's a conversation between two characters about what it means for this stewardship, this conservation of nature for man. You spoke of the judgment of trees in these matters, but trees are not judges. The children of the one are the masters. If the smallest child of a woodsman feels the cold of winter, the proudest tree is not wronged if it is bidden to surrender its flesh to warm the child with the fire. But the child must not mar the tree in play or spite or rip its bark or its branches. The good husbandsman will first use, if he can, dead wood or an old tree. He will not fell a young tree and leave it to rot for no better reason than his pleasure in axe play. So we are, at the sense, the pinnacle of creation. We are the masters, the judges of the material world, but we're limited, like a good judge, by what we owe in justice to this world. And so much of our technology, so much of our quest for this mastery over nature leads us to ignore those constraints.
This is just so, this speaks so closely to the podcast we just did with Ross Douthat, actually about worshiping nature and the way that, like, obviously there's a sense in which, you know, one has to care for nature, but one can't worship it. And worshiping nature can come in the form of kind of, you know, nature in the way that we understand it, sort of like the natural world, or it can come in the sense of worshiping immanent forces in the world. So like the gods of trees, the gods of streams, as opposed to worshiping the high god. And just like forgetting our place as stewards, as beings who are not as imminent as elves and ents are.
But there's a sort of, there's an equal and kind of reverse temptation, which is if you empty, you know, on the one hand, there's a temptation to sort of polytheistically worship every rock or tree. But the opposite temptation, which we're sort of discovering at the moment, is if you desacralize and disenchant every rock and tree, if you don't believe there's a kind of intelligence and a spirit that lives in things and that knows and worships God, you start worshipping human beings themselves, because human beings are the only thing, in that case, made in the image of God. They're the only things that worship God. The world has been given to us as our kind of victim. And you start going into the kind of dark Baconian territory of, you know, we'll discover the secrets of nature via torture, like a recalcitrant mute prisoner that can't be trusted to give its own account.
Right, and there's that sense in which you also, you fall into the orc play of cutting up trees and leaving them because you can. Yeah, because you can, it becomes a manifestation of power.
You know, if that hideous strength is Lewis's Charles Williams novel, then Perelandra really seems to me to be his Tolkien novel, in that sense. Just because I'm thinking of the, was it Perelandra or was it Out of the Silent Planet, where Weston, like when he's fully possessed, is just like going around ripping like the backbones out of frogs.
That's Perelandra.
Is it Perelandra? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And that one also has some oblique and some more obvious references to the Silmarillion or to what
tell me
Tolkien
more about that. Tell me.
Well, for example, the names of the two main beings, I don't want to, like the Adam and Eve. Yeah. Tor and Tinadril. Tor and Idril of the Silmarillion.
What is a Silmaril? Just because I have not read it. I haven't read it. I'm sorry.
Wow. Yeah, that's practically the entire plot of the Silmarillion. But okay, I'm going to try.
Don't tell me. I'm serious. I take it back. Don't tell me. Because okay. I don't want to spoil it for anyone else either. I just have to read the book. Alistair's read them all in detail. I've only read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. I'm sorry. I know.
I mean, we should probably talk about the Silmarils, actually, because they are sort of, because I do think they cast a very interesting light on the Lord of the Rings. So, again, in some ways, it's sort of similar to Lord of the Rings. The Silmarils basically are kind of holders of the kind of inner essence of a beautiful thing that would otherwise be lost. So they're an attempt to kind of like sustain and sort of control something that would otherwise be dying. And I mean, just to try to give it really briefly, basically in the kind of cosmic history of Lord of the Rings, there are these two trees that light the world before the sun and the moon. The trees are destroyed through the actions of Melkor, who's sort of the kind of Satan of this universe. So the light of the trees leaves the world, but the only place they continue to exist is where, through the actions of Feanor, who's this kind of genius elven smith who lives out in the west with the gods, and he basically contains the light of the two trees in these Silmarils. So basically this is kind of almost like, you've got to imagine something like the first light of creation, you know, something like kind of almost like kind of the Logos or something, and if we were trying to create an analogy, you know, something that sort of the original beauty of reality is captured in these objects. So they don't have a practical value. They're just almost like these objects that just somehow embody beauty and meaning and significance and everything that's been lost. And the Silmarils are the kind of great treasures of sort of the valor, the gods, or the angels, if you prefer, of this sort of work of this cosmos, and they're lost, they're stolen, and the sun and the and you know, Feanor's sons swear this oath to recapture them, and then they pursue the Silmarils and Melkor into Middle-earth. And I mean, I won't give the whole rest of it, but that's, and of course, most of them are eventually lost, except, of course, for one that's recovered and is eventually made into a star. So I'm not going to give too much more of it away, but it gets very involved. But basically, they do come into the books, though generally in a kind of indirect way. So that, for example, the light that... I don't know if you remember the jewel that Frodo is given, that he uses to... get rid of Shelob. That's basically the reflected light of a Silmaril. So it's kind of light. So you get lots of these things which are sort of, there's a lot of stuff which is about, and copying is maybe not the right word, but there are these sense of these kind of reflections, you know, exactly, yeah.
And Tolkien even says of this, of Feanor, that of the creation of the Silmarils, that this particular branch of the High Elves was concerned and always on the side of science and technology, as we should call it. So there is a sense of the three elves that go to the west, that see the light of the trees before they're destroyed. They represent almost like these three aspects of human civilization. The highest of the high elves, who I'm blanking on the name of, but the Vanyar, the highest of the high elves, they represent kind of the nobility of order, the nobility of rule. The Noldor, the side of science and technology, of knowledge and making, smithing. And the Teleri are lovers of the sea, lovers of boats and travel on the sea. And these are all things that only come with human civilization, that only come with the progress of man out of survival conditions, out of this primitive survival existence, which is, I think, falsely called the state of nature. But there's nothing inherently evil about them, but it's the elves of technology, it's the elves of science that are the ones to fall. And that is, I think, a warning.
It's interesting, though, because, of course, it's only because of the, you know, so you put it, the elves of technology, the Noldor, that the light of the two trees is preserved. So that's sort of the paradox, that the act of repair and preservation relies on this kind of technology, but it's also the potential source for possession and corruption. So it's once the light is something that can be possessed, that it becomes dangerous. But it's only because it's made into an object that it survives at all.
Yeah, and I think I was too hard on the preservation side earlier. I think I do agree with you. There is this nobility and this beauty in preservation, which I also think there's a beauty and nobility in progress. I think Tolkien recognized that with his love of motor cars, but not in untrammeled progress, not in turning everything into a resource and into an object.
Well, the thing that's very interesting, of course, is that the light is translated into an object that causes war and destruction and tears apart families. And it causes almost like the fall of these kind of rebel angels in the form of the Noldor. But at the same time, it's then retranslated into a star so that it goes back to being a part of the natural order. And so, sorry, actually, I should say, it's more literal than that. It's not just, so one of them goes into the water, one of them goes down into the earth, into the fire, and one of them goes into the sky. So that effectively, the light goes back into the natural world, so that there's a kind of dialectical process in which, you know, the light of the trees is rescued by this act of making, but then it's sort of pure, it's repurified and redeemed by this act of, I mean, unmaking maybe is not the right word, but certainly of sacrifice. So you have to embody, you have to make, but then there's a second act of making, which is purifying, which is giving away. So it's gift. There's a very strong gift economy behind it all, that you make an object, then you have to give it away. It's when you try to possess the thing that you make that it becomes corrupted. So that objects have to be perpetually redeemed by the act of gift, And it's when it becomes subject to exchange and competition that they become dangerous.
Yeah, and I did want to note too that the Silmaril that becomes a star by means of a spaceship, by a ship that is made into Arendelle the Messenger. His ship is transformed into a ship of mithril and elven glass, so metal and glass, a kind of spaceship to travel in the
wow.
sky.
I mean, it's just, it's so, it's this approach to the complexity of technology and the way that, and out of progress is, it just feels entirely Old Testament-ish, Old Testament and then Book of Revelation. So, you know, obviously, you know, we are intended to be, you know, to do the creation mandate, to build and to make and to fill and to form and to fill. But then we screw it up. And then the first person who actually starts to do that is Cain, who builds a city for his son and names it after his son, and which is like a pure act of ego. It's not, you know, a gift to his son. It's just sort of like, I have made this boy, and then I am also making a city, and I'm naming them both because they're both acts of my will. But then there's Bezalel, the craftsman, who in obedience to God is making beautiful things for the temple. And then there's a vision at the end of, in the Book of Revelation of, you know, the nations of the earth and the kings of the earth bringing their glory, bringing the things that they have made that are glorious to God. Like, so all of those, you know, all of that ambition is redeemed through a gift economy.
Now you could almost map, you can have your Silmarillion Old Testament and the Lord of the Rings as your New Testament, because there's that redemption of Numenor in Aragorn's restoration of the kingdoms of the West, of Arnor and Gondor. There's the elevation of the city in Minas Tirith, originally this fortress, and originally a colony, a kind of a thing that was planted to control these surrounding areas, to exercise domination, becomes instead a symbol, a bastion of freedom against the tyranny of Sauron, and a symbol of hope for the rebuilding of Middle-earth.
It's very hard, yeah. Minas Tirith is Rome.
I think Tolkien said it was roughly on the same latitude as Florence. So
okay, there we go. Yeah,
maybe that's the real second Rome.
Yeah, and there's some interesting similarities in the layout, the rough layout of Minas Tirith and Vienna, and you can see the siege of Vienna is also another nice parallel.
Well, and of course the armies of the East do turn up in, you know, problematic Orientalist fashion.
Right, I'm gonna have to link. Yeah, I'm unfortunately going to have to link my very ridiculous Venice and Vienna piece in the show notes of this, because now I'm re-experiencing the last month and a half of my life through these through this new information, this new wisdom that I'm receiving from you guys. If our listeners have, if their appetites have been whetted by this conversation, other than just reading The Hobbit and then The Lord of the Rings, what would you recommend? What are good ways in to the rest of this world?
Well, if they haven't already, I think everyone should read On Fairy Stories, because this touches on many of the themes that we've talked about in this episode regarding magic and technology, and some of the stuff that I thought maybe we could get into, but maybe for another time, Tolkien on science fiction, because that's such a fascinating process.
I'm sorry, you have to tell me. I know, even if I have to cut this, I need to know this.
It's interesting that he has this kind of ambivalent relationship with science fiction. He's a great reader of science fiction. He notes Asimov as one of his favorite authors. And in the Notion Club papers, there's pages and pages of a digression. It's basically like a fictionalized version of the Inklings, though none of the members correspond to any of the real life members exactly. Just discussing whether or not science fiction stories or stories set on other planets and other worlds should include spaceships, or whether that's not believable. But he touches on in fairy stories this idea that part of the problem is in this genre that is the most fantastical, in this genre where like you can see futures and distant worlds and all these things that are so beyond our ordinary experience, we just imagine the same kind of progress that we've seen up to this point in the 20th century. Part of our problem is that we can no longer imagine that these things of the anything will change in a way. We'll still have factories the same way we have in the future. We'll still have cars and machine guns and things in the future. That these are natural and inevitable, even though they're the most artificial things about our present day. They're the things that we choose to incorporate into the world. And so I think that's this. All of these themes come together in On Fairy Stories, and all of this. It's a very readable format. It was originally a lecture he gave that got incorporated into various books, but it really gets to the heart of this discussion.
And I'll just add a sort of small addendum to that, that of course Tolkien did consider writing a sequel to Lord of the Rings, and he chose not to, in part precisely because of what you're saying, because he felt that once the elves had gone, that he would basically just be writing like a bad political drama, you know, and it's interesting that the risk of the more fantastical you try to get, the more you just sort of circle back to what you know, because you have so few other kind of points of reference.
It would have become Game of Thronesy. It would have just been like the history of the men in Middle Earth. There's a question that I have for you guys, just because I've been thinking about it for some random reason lately, which is, so the idea of a genre of story or speculation or thought that is what will happen in the future and how will the future be different, I guess it starts with Thomas More's Utopia, sort of, or something like that, or the New Atlantis, I guess. But why, what happened to our brains in like the 17th century and then 18th and 19th century that we started to think about the future as a different place to visit and tell stories about? Like, what was that?
Part of it, I think, because the primary author I'm familiar with who does that kind of thing is H.G. Wells, right? He not only writes stories like The Time Machine, where characters travel into the future. He wrote a whole fake textbook called The Shape of Things to Come, which is basic. It's like a history textbook of stuff that hasn't happened. It is the fact that, to a certain extent, our technology and our understanding of the world is cumulative. It is something that builds throughout the ages. We know more now about certain things, certain processes, and have the ability to make bigger machines than we did in previous ages, and that excitement at that prospect really starts to unfold in the 19th century. You see these rapid technological changes because we'd reached a point where all of that accumulated knowledge could be built upon and could be experimented upon and tested and produce actual results. If you think about the amount of time it took for us to go from the first motor car to landing on the moon, in historical terms, is an incredibly short amount of time because it's building on all this knowledge of the past ages. And so seeing that change, that I think naturally propelled these kinds of stories. But there's a kind of optimism in these stories too that I think can tend to gloss over we've seen the positive effects. We've yet to fully understand the negative effects, although we're starting to really kind of understand that now, I think, a lot more and more people. are starting to understand that. But yeah, there is an intoxication to progress that makes us want to talk about it and imagine it.
In the face of a kind of world where that is the primary imaginative space, I guess. The future is the kind of primary imaginative space that we live in. Even, you know, with our contemporary sort of Palantir wielding overlords. What would Tolkien say to us?
Well, I think it is, you get the sense from On Fairy Stories and from other works of Tolkien that mythopoeia, especially the poem that he composed defending mythology to Lewis, we do need to look backwards. We do need to look back on the previous ages and see the elves. We need to see the ennoblement and the enchantment of our history before we can look forwards and see, okay, where are we going to take this? What are we going to bring with us into this future? What are we going to preserve? Like Sebastian was saying, this art of preservation, what are we going to bring forward with us to guide us? Like, you know, the Silmaril becomes a star, a literal, like a guiding star to the protagonists of The Lord of the Rings. That continuity, that sense of allowing the noble elements of the past to bring us into the future. I think that's a really strong theme in The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and maybe what are we going to reforge?
Right.
And I think it's that precise theme of nobility in the face of often traumatic, irreversible change that's so powerful in Tolkien. And I think that's what makes him a modern author rather than just a kind of Edwardian romantic. Because there's a sense of it, because we're so familiar with Tolkien, it's hard to stand back and kind of look at it. But again, this is a fantasy novel in which industrial technology shows up halfway through. Like, I don't think you can kind of understate that. It's a confrontation between utterly different kind of worlds and realities that are kind of spinning apart. And, you know, in one way, it's an innately conservative novel, but not in the simple sense of, you know, sort of small-mindedness or attachment to the past. But I think it's much more in its ability to almost revive a, you know, sort of deep, you know, Anglo-Saxon-infused tragic sense of reality. It's full of this sense of, you know, beauty slipping away and the necessity of a kind of heroic, almost irrationally hopeful courage, even in the face of, like, the complete collapse of entire ways of life and civilizations. So it's sort of a manual for how to sort of keep human nature, you know, the highest bullets of human nature going in an age of sort of massive technological change.
And I will say, it's, I think what distinguishes it from that past Anglo-Saxon tragedy is that it's not ultimately a tragedy. It's getting us through the tragedy to the restoration on the other side, to the kind of reversal that doesn't undo the past. Like, the stuff happens, and the stuff that happens is incorporated into that future. But, you know, you have at the end of The Lord of the Rings the scouring of the Shire. It leaves marks on the Shire, but ultimately what comes out is not only a restoration of the Shire, but an ennoblement and beautification of it through these powerful gifts, like the gift of the Valar tree.
Well, on that note, you guys, I think it's probably time to wrap. Thank you both so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having
I'm
me.
I'm really delighted by this episode. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast needs met, and share with your friends. For a lot more content like this, check out plow.com for the digital magazine. You can also subscribe. $36 a year will get you the print magazine, or for $99 a year, you can become a member of Plow. That membership carries a whole range of benefits, from free books to regular calls with the editors to invitations to special events and the occasional gift. Go to plow.com to learn more. On our next episode, I'll be talking with Joy Clarkson on her new book, You Are a Tree, and Other Metaphors to Nourish Life.